John Pang, how's it going? This is the Escape from Plan A for this week. John, it's always, people are always excited when you're back. I don't know what it is, but they're always like, yeah, I want to hear John Pang. I was like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Fine. Nah, you're too kind.
I was like, I gotta.
Yeah, you have a great audience.
Oh, they really enjoy your takes. Yeah. And there's a lot to have takes on. You know, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot, and it's nice to have a balanced opinion from someone who's actually in China, because I speculate a lot, but you've been in both places, and so you could see the difference in the flesh. And I think there's a lot to talk about here, because we're what is it, way less than 2 months, I mean 6 weeks into the Trump presidency.
Yeah.
All hell is breaking loose.
Man, I mean, but I'm away, but not away. We're in each, in the US and China, we're in each other's face so much, right? Mm-hmm. I was at dinner, one of these regular sort of Chinese dinners the other day, where you have all these nice dishes, and this is the kind of dinner in which business gets done, right? All the baijiu and all this stuff. And this other guy, where he finds out, I was living in the US and so on. He wants to know about Trump. Right? Mm-hmm. Hey, that's the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is interest.
I mean, that's the, yeah, go on.
Seems to be real interest in Trump. I think Trump attracts a lot of attention and is sort of inherently interesting, and I think I've noticed Chinese people are drawn to him in a certain way.
Yes, they are. Of course, they don't have the liberal lens, or area, which immediately, as for some people, just is like a certain filter. And they can no longer consider anything about Trump. He's just evil, or just a bad man, and there's nothing to even think about. So they don't have that.
The Trump derangement syndrome, we call it.
No, they don't have Trump derangement syndrome. So they do find him kind of interesting. I think a lot of people prefer someone who just says what's on his mind, as opposed to, 4 years of Biden and Blinken, which is really horrible. The kind of, these passive aggressive and never always speaking with a forked tongue sort of guys. But with Trump, you have this, of course, this unpredictability, erratic thing and so on. You're between two things. On one hand, things could go really, really bad. And on the other hand, what is this guy trying to do? Is he trying to sort of, cut a big deal with China? So it is interesting. Yeah,
which is, I think, what we should talk about, just because, storm clouds are brewing. But I would say that, I've been complaining a lot about Trump and Doge and his assault on the U.S. government. And people will ask me, all right, do you regret voting for him? And I'm like, no, I got everything I paid for. Because I still think that, the formula for my decision and why I was glad to see Trump win was because, I think Kamala would just be a continuation of these anonymous, sort of generic liberals who would just continue the same policy of trying to unify the country through a neocon war to end all wars. And as opposed to Trump, who I think was like, look, we have domestic conflicts to settle, and we're not going to settle them abroad. We're going to settle them here. And I am not particularly aligned with a lot of his domestic agenda. However, I would rather have that fight here, because I think it's legitimate, then watch, a bland liberal, jump headfirst into every potential war abroad that they can at all at the same time. And I don't know. I think Trump has been doing a pretty decent job of trying to extricate the U.S. from conflicts. And it's not beautiful. It's not, you know, it's not a pretty process. And, you know, I know a lot of people would probably poke holes in what he's doing, but I'm like, he did move. I think he exercised more control over Israel than Biden ever has, although it's not great. And he certainly has controlled Zelensky and this, and the European allies. Yeah, so
absolutely.
I think I got what I paid for.
Yeah, no,
you know,
absolutely. I don't think, it's no contest for me. With Kamala, you would have had just a continuation of the same, but then, you know, you're sliding down a slope and you know where this thing is headed. It's as if these guys had these guardrails and they're just going right down to oblivion, right? But with Trump, there's a bit of there's a bit of roll of the dice, but his first 6 weeks have been extraordinary on that front, on the foreign policy front. I mean, what more could you ask? He's breaking up NATO, the alliance with Europe in some respects, and of course, an actual proxy war. Now they can actually use that term. Remember Rubio actually saying it?
Yeah.
We're in this proxy war. So, I mean, this is an absolutely dangerous conflict. So, I mean, there's no contest. Where would we be with the Biden or Harris administration right now? Good God. I mean, just exactly where Europe is intending to go. So it looks dangerous, but... and of course, there's all that crude stuff. But I almost don't want to have to say this. It's obvious the guy is crude and rude and crazy, you know, seemingly erratic. But it's what he's delivered, what he's done so far in the first few weeks is extraordinary. There's a lot of bad stuff along with it. But on the foreign policy side, in terms of just taking some distance from war, and taking the U.S. back from this cycle of escalation, I think it's really good.
I think so too. I think it's a bit of a stress relief in a way. It's almost like, you know, do you let pressure build up until we have like a magnitude 9, you know, earthquake that destroys everything, or do we just like go ahead and have the little catastrophes now and let history take its course, and instead of just damming up the pressure, let's see the writing on the wall and just, you know, have it out now. You know what I mean? Have it out now.
Yeah, you may complain about some of the recklessness or some of the kind of lack of decorum in the behavior or whatnot, but these are almost, you know, this is to really focus on the wrong thing right now when. You just look back at what we faced before this, before January 20th. Just escalation towards nuclear war by these ideological wing nuts.
Yeah, I mean, and Zelensky is such a compromised figure. I mean, like, he really need to be put in his
place.
You're
too kind.
Yeah, he's really horrendous. And
horrendous.
He is a dictator. I don't know how there's any, like, it's so gross when they try to defend the fact that they suspended elections, going like, how can you hold elections during war? You know, and I'm like, like, all of them overlook the fact that all of us have seen countless videos of people being dragged off the street into kidnap vans so that they can become cannon fodder.
And yeah.
That the U.S. has been actively pressuring Ukraine to drop its conscription age to 18 so that they can legally kidnap children. I mean, basically children. Do they not, like, it's so ugly and so obscene, and they keep trying to throw these disgusting drapes over it as if this dictator who has suspended democratic elections and has no popular support is somehow the hero of democracy. And I'm like, we are, you know, we should be the shining light, you know, for the Ukrainian people. Meanwhile, we're advocating for 18 and 19 year olds to be dragged off the street and conscripted into a war for which they basically have no chance, and they're going to be destroyed. Like, they're going to be killed immediately. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And we're lying. We keep lying about how the Russians are, you know, they're falling apart, they're running for the hills. And I'm like, no, you're forcing them into a metal storm. they're gonna die.
They've lied for 3 years. It was clear from the start what was going on. It was clear to me, right? And it was out there. There were people discussing this. It was clear that they, you know, there's a massive propaganda effort. I mean, the greatest in living memory was put on for this. And now people can just actually say what we're hearing, that this is a proxy war, for example, that the Russians actually have a point. They have a legitimate concern, at least from their perspective.
And they're also winning.
For their security.
Bottom line, they're winning. I mean, for so long, the media has been lying about this. Thing, yeah. And Trump just said, your country is in a bad position. It's not in a good position. What does Zelensky say?
Yeah.
I know. That's what he said. He said, right. I know. That's all it took. Just ask him in public, what's the situation here for you? It is bad, isn't it? And he said, I know it's bad.
Yep.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be here begging. You know what I mean?
Actually, begging and demanding.
Begging and demanding. Yep.
There's this strange sort of, sadomasochistic dance that Zelensky has been playing with the Europeans and then also with the Democrats, in which the side that's supposed to be, that he's appealing to is sort of enjoys the humiliation, or they play the game in which, you're sort of humiliated by this guy talking down to you and telling you, you know, you have to give more and more and more. And he had gotten used to that. And that press conference with, or that sit down, you know, in the Oval Office with Trump and Vance and Rubio, he really asked for it. I'm not sure that, you know, some people think he was jumped, that it was staged to trap him. If you watch the whole thing, I mean, it's hard not to snap at the guy at some point, not to tell him off at some point.
Yeah, there's a point people where he said, may I answer the question too? And they let him talk, and then he basically contradicted everything they said. And I think Vance at that point noticed what was going on and said, don't litigate this in front of the media. Like, you're here to ask
He attacked Vance first,
you know.
I mean, Vance wasn't even attacking him. When Vance was talking about diplomacy, Vance was answering a fairly aggressive question, I think, from a Polish journalist. Vance wasn't addressing Zelensky at that point. He was answering that question, and Zelensky got offended by, this talk of diplomacy.
Yeah.
And then went on this rhetorical, you know, asked this rhetorical question, what do you mean by diplomacy and so on, and just attacked Vance in front of Trump. It was really ugly.
It was a really remarkable thing to see, because I feel like, I think a lot of this is, you know, we got to see what the backroom dealing actually can look like, and it's a lot uglier. And brutal. You know, it involves personalities. It involves, Trump is right? He's saying, like,
it's great to see the emotions.
Yeah, he's saying there's an element of, like, interpersonal conflict to what is great power conflict, meaning, like, you know, the personality matters. The inflection, the way that you handle people matters. It is a geopolitical, it is a strategic, large-scale conflict that gets litigated as a personal conflict. It's really weird, I gotta say, I mean, I enjoyed watching the American president flex a little on this little man,
I enjoyed it thoroughly,
and say, look, I don't forget who it's the
about
fuck
time
you are. Yeah, don't forget who you are,
yeah,
relative to who I am. And people may not like that, because, you know, we don't want to be treated that way, and we've been taught to identify with Zelensky rather than our own country. But
yeah,
I still identify with the United States. I don't identify with Ukraine, and I'm glad that he exercised the level of control over this little goblin, you know, who just seeks more war and to pull us into a war that I don't know why we care about this war, but I've not heard anyone make any argument as to why I should support this war and as an American. And this little goblin comes in and he wants another tens or hundreds of billions of dollars and a security guarantee that would pull American troops into Ukraine. And I'm like, why? For what? For you? Yeah,
exactly.
For your well-being? Who are you? You know, you're this little 5'3" with an attitude midget. What are you doing here? So I was glad to see them put him in his place. And I don't know. It's ugly, but it's like, fuck you, dude. You know?
No, but the other thing is that the whole thing, the whole Zelensky thing is such a show, such a performance from the start. If you know, step out of the bubble, the media bubble for a moment, and just look at what we're dealing with here, you know, a coked up comedian, clearly just there as a kind of performer. I mean, I just don't buy all this, the way, or I can see the way they've sort of built him up as a kind of Churchillian figure and so on. And it's just so fake.
Oh, it's so
sorry, fake. I can't get into it. It's so fake.
Yeah, it's so fake.
Right?
Yeah.
And then if you understand a little bit about the country, or you learn a little bit about the country, that is a kleptocracy, that, you know, he was the product of an election. He was backed by one billionaire, one oligarch against another oligarch. Just look at the whole thing. I mean, people would just grow up. I just can't do it anymore. Just pretend that I'm not watching really puerile behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, showing up in the Oval Office with that, what the fuck was he wearing? Yeah. I mean, you know, it wasn't his usual, you know, dirty green sweater or whatever it was, but he made this thing up and it had this kind of Azov or this you know, Nazi adjacent symbol on it. You know, you just show up there dressed like that because you're exceptional, right? You're supposed to be able to talk down to even Trump because you have the moral high ground. You're the victim. And these guys just weren't buying it. It was just like walking into a room full of, or walking the room with a pretty hard-boiled guy on the other side.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was it. He got what he deserved. And then some people say, well, it's tragic for Ukraine, etc. But it is tragic for Ukraine. And the sooner we wrap this up or we come to some sort of to a ceasefire, the better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, that actually was a moment in which people felt really, I think, a lot of relief that finally certain things could be said. You know, after that, you could say, okay, you could acknowledge this is a proxy conflict with Russia, and therefore you can solve it. You can try to address it with diplomacy. No, diplomacy is back, man. I mean, this is diplomacy.
It is.
What Trump
is
trying
to do. It is with Russia. Okay, well,
this
leads us to, I think, the core of what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Which is, I do think that in many ways, this is clearing the way for a confrontation with China. I know in the past I said that I don't believe that there's any likelihood of war or whatever, and I still don't in terms of like a military war. Mm-hmm. However, I do think that we are gearing up for a major economic confrontation with China, because the more I think about it, the more I think let's start from the basis, right? From the basics here.
Yeah.
The foundation.
Yeah.
I believe that the Trump administration is aligned within itself to the idea that the United States is facing the U.S. government is facing a looming debt and solvency crisis. Now, without getting into the technicalities of whether that's true or not, whether 6% budget deficits against GDP is too hot, whether we have spiraling debt, you know, all this stuff. Like, that's for, you know, economists to argue, but I think it's clear to me that the administration believes that we are way over the ski tips here in terms of the budget deficit that we're running, the scale of the government debts. They are very serious about scaling back government debts to about 3%, which I think is the Dalio pledge, is the Ray Dalio mm-hmm. pledge, which is we need to get it to 3%. For whatever reason, 3% is the magic number. We've got to basically cut our budget deficit in half. They are talking about scaling back. You know, Doge is out there cutting whatever it can from the federal government through mass firings and canceling of contracts. They're serious about this. And the other side of this is they're very concerned about deindustrialization. And I think that's where China is part of this. I do think at bottom that they are, the administration is pointing out something true about this, about the U.S. economy, which is that I think they know that a lot of our GDP is fake, and that unless we have manufacturing and capability, that a lot of this is, they view it as government make work. Scott Bessent's strategy in terms of tackling this growing this sort of like rising interest rate at the same time as we have rising debts is to say we need to move our GDP base away from government spending towards private sector, meaning we need industry back and we need a scaled back government sector that's just sort of like spending on bullshit. And there's truth to that. There's truth to that. So I think that's the basis of where this government, where this administration is coming from. I think they're essentially right. I just don't know if they have any solid options.
Well, you laid it out very well in that Substack of yours, the most recent post. There's a coherent argument, right, to be made that this tariff strategy lines up with a coherent strategy. That this tariff, well, there's a reason, there's a rhyme behind there's reason behind the rhyme. Is that it? So that they are doing this with the not in a haphazard way, that the plan is the tariff strategy is connected with that they want to devalue China, for example, right? They're trying to push in a direction that empowers the U.S. manufacturing, U.S. industry, and at the same time forces the Chinese into a position in which they have to bargain, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure when you ask if it's too late. Of course, I think it is, because while I think that they have a plan behind it and I can sort of see it, I don't see how it's going to work. In the end, it's going to fail like the sanctions.
Probably.
Right, they think the tariffs are going to be paid by the Chinese eventually through devaluation.
Yeah.
But devaluation is not what they ultimately want from the Chinese. They basically, actually, they want, the RMB appreciating, the US dollar, finally achieving a lower exchange rate relative to these currencies.
Let me ask you.
To make US industry, right.
Okay, so
yeah, go on.
Here Varoufakis is making the point, and this is the
article. It's Varoufakis' point I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, so he's saying, ultimately, what they want is a sort of Plaza Accord settlement with China so that China actually appreciates its currency, so that the U.S. actually has breathing room here in order to sort of reindustrialize and actually balance out this trade deficit with China, which is something that's huge. I mean, it's the largest trade deficit that we run. And
right.
Okay. So that I think is probably unrealistic, but you know, what about this? I'm wondering if actually this is actually just containment strategy where all right, let me this is so convoluted. This is why I don't think anything's
it is convoluted.
Nothing's
yeah,
gonna I, work.
I'm struggling
convoluted.
With it.
How can you run a strategy that's convoluted? But Sometimes I think what the U.S. is trying to do with tariffs is sort of create a sort of dollar zone, the way that, like, sort of similar to the Eurozone, sort of create a global dollar zone where the United States is sort of the Germany of the dollar zone, if that makes sense. Meaning, like, okay, Germany had the the Eurozone was a big win for Germany over many decades because it
undervalued the German.
Yeah, they dominated what would have been German currency. Right. All the industry concentrated there because they were the most efficient manufacturer, and none of the trade partners within the Eurozone could do anything about it because they couldn't devalue their currency.
Yeah, it undervalued German exports, right?
Yeah, and so just Germany came to dominate the Eurozone. I feel like that's what they want for the U.S., but in a dollar zone. And the tariffs are meant to create the conditions of a de facto dollar zone, meaning that, you know, a country will be punished for devaluing its currency. We're going to use tariffs to make sure that a sort of currency parity is reached of the kind that Germany enjoyed vis-a-vis the rest of the Eurozone.
Yeah.
And I wonder if what they'll do in terms of, you know, like in his view is like, we're going to set up the tariffs, punish each country with these horrible tariffs, and then allow them to negotiate their way back out of it. I wonder if one of the key elements of that negotiation is that they actually put tariffs on China. So we'll create like a tariff zone against China around the world. And the point of that simply is to limit.
Trying that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They already pressured Mexico to do this, and I think Canada.
Oh,
as well.
Really? To put up to say that the conditions for us dropping tariffs is that you have to raise tariffs on China.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So it's a sort of broadening the tariff effect. So yeah, exactly.
See, if that's the strategy, then I can see why the Chinese are very upset. Mm-hmm. Because this is another. This is another attempt.
It's a thing you picked up. I picked up too. Chinese language has shifted, right?
Oh yeah,
it's much more it's much more aggressive now. It's much more openly it's no longer couched in these niceties, right? If you want whatever kind of war you want, we're going to follow you with in that
until the end.
We're with you until the end. We're with you to the end.
Wow.
Yeah, the Chinese phrase is sort of I'm with you. You want to dance? whichever way you want, we're gonna. Yeah,
the rather unfortunate thing is, I think the Americans will view that as a sort of like tough talk means that you're scared. Tough talk means that you're desperate. This means you're scared. It actually might make the Americans feel like they've actually got the Chinese shook, and I'm not sure that that's the case. I feel like.
Yeah,
that kind of change in rhetoric is China giving fair warning, because this is the point of my blog post was like, China actually has the capacity to wage a pretty destructive campaign against the United States.
Yeah,
very destructive. Yeah. What we've tried to do to China in order to contain their technological advancements, which have been just sort of like accelerating, like ever since we've tried to to destroy Huawei, fully destroy it. We would have loved to see Huawei just go out of business.
That was the intention.
I think that was the intention. Yeah. Was to literally put them out of business. Since we started that, I feel like the rate of innovation in China has only accelerated.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the whole thing backfired.
No, it's become a you've added a kind of a nationalist fervor to it, a patriotic fervor. You know, you've you've given them that. If it was just business before, it was just about getting rich. Now, especially in Huawei, it's there's a real kind of patriotic fervor around you know this project, and you can feel it. It's all across the tech space. So no, it's not a smart thing to have done. You basically, I mean, what Biden did was do Chinese industrial policy for them, right? As people have pointed out before, we're not the first to point this out. It was like a forcing function on Chinese industry. It was stuff that even Xi Jinping would have had a hard time persuading industry they needed to do. For example, to build their own CPUs and GPUs. So they were content to buy this stuff, and the government action that would have been necessary, the harsh measures, the tough measures that would have been necessary to get this degree of local content in, you did it for them. The US did it for them. So
yeah, and now
it couldn't be more effective. And now they're going to have an end-to-end chain. It's a really scary prospect.
Yeah, and now I don't think
they would have achieved this in years.
You know? Yeah, and now I feel like if we're going to watch the Chinese get stronger, telegraph our strategy for this long, and the Chinese have had nearly a decade now since the first round of the trade war began under Trump. You know, we're in the ninth year of this, right? Like, I don't think the U.S. has done shit to really prepare for it, and yet we're the ones going in guns blazing. And I feel like the change in rhetoric to me seems ominous, and I started freaking out about it a little bit, thinking like, do I need to adjust my own position here in terms of like where I put my money? Because I could put it this way, DeepSeek wiped out $1 trillion of U.S. stock market value overnight in one day by releasing a good product. What could China do to the stock market in the United States if they actually sought to sabotage it? If they wanted to coordinate an economic
That's
attack?
A brilliant question. Yeah.
If they could do $1 trillion through one product release, think what they could do if they actually put their minds to it. It's quite terrifying if you think about it.
Yeah. And that says something not just about the dependence on China or the interdependence, but also about the nature of the US economy, doesn't it?
I mean,
it's because the AI thing in the US, the AI was such a bubble, or is such a bubble, that you could lose $1 trillion.
Yeah, I mean, it's super.
It's because
leveraged.
It's so bloody inflated. That right, there's so much froth to it. If it wasn't so heavily leveraged and so overhyped, you couldn't do this. So the US is in a pretty vulnerable position to be playing this game, basically.
It's funny because I posted like, okay, a lot of the danger is right under our nose, right? Like, it's so obvious to be almost naive to point it out. But I'm like, just pull up Apple's 10K filing, right? Just pull up their annual report. And it says right at the very top, because, the main regulatory purpose of these disclosures is to, as a risk disclosure, right? The main purpose is to inform investors of the risks that they face when investing in this company. And the number one risk in every Apple filing, every 3 months, and at the end of every year, the main risk is that substantially all of our manufacturing takes place in China. That's the main risk.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious. Everyone knows this. It's so abundantly clear that we seem to forget it, if that makes sense. Like, it's so obvious that Apple is completely vulnerable to supply chain shocks by China that we don't really talk about it. And the idea that China could literally destroy Apple, which is still by far our largest company. NVIDIA and Microsoft are actually substantially smaller, even with the stock bubble. You know, they're on the verge of like what, a $4 trillion valuation. I just realized, I'm like, the Chinese could destroy the single largest American company overnight. And another
reason people don't notice is the Chinese don't threaten it directly. They haven't, but they might come to the point that they have to now. There is so much about this that they haven't been obvious about.
Yeah.
And they haven't had to point out, but then you're forcing them to do this.
Yeah, I pointed this out in a lot of like pro-Chinese accounts and stuff are just like sort of yelling at me because they're like, why would China do this? You're stupid. All you people can think about is war. And I'm like, okay, but that's not my point. My point is, well, my point is that China is actually talking about war now, number one. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference I realize is, you know, like when you're in the logic of like economics and trade, like you're goal is self-maximization. So the question of like, why would China do this? This is so destructive. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense if China is in a, you know, in a cooperative mood. But if the switch gets turned and China's like, okay, we're at war now, then the logic goes from how do I maximize my own position to how do I maximally destroy your position? And I'm like, wow, we're quite vulnerable. You know what I mean? Like everything that we tried to do to Huawei but failed, they could do to Apple, which is our equivalent of Huawei. They could do that to Apple overnight. Overnight. They could wipe out that company. They would completely disrupt their ability to source iPhones, MacBooks, Apple Watches, whatever the hell they sell. All of that stuff could be immediately frozen. And it wouldn't take much. They do have to do just take out one critical component maker. That's it. That they can't have an easy replacement for, and that's it, and they're done. And does Bessin and Trump know this? I don't know. Like, do they realize like how under the gun our economy is when it comes to Chinese, or are they gonna go guns blazing thinking that we can fight a currency war against them, or that we can fight a sort of like tariff war against them? Meanwhile, our entire supply chain is being in China.
They're focused on the abstractions. They're focused on this high-level stuff.
They really are.
They're not looking at components. They're not looking at supply chains.
That's right. That's right.
They only get specific when they're attacking Huawei, and that was pretty specific. That was very concrete. Mm-hmm. They wanted to end this company. They kidnapped the daughter of the
Jesus Christ
founder.
Yeah,
I mean, so, but the rest of the time they don't seem to think about it. Look, I think it really is interesting. I haven't, I agree with you. This shift in Chinese language and this is notable. They're just being much more direct now. Maybe it's for Trump's benefit, because with this guy, you have to make it clear. But you're right. They have a lot of cards that they haven't played. To use Trump's phrase, they have a lot of cards and they haven't played. And I just don't think that the Chinese economy or China as an enterprise is as fragile as the US right now.
And you know, if you're China,
despite all the talk about China collapsing, right?
You know, if
I think if they really came to blows,
I'm assuming that on the Chinese side, like there are people who advocate for a more aggressive approach and there are people who advocate for a more cooperative approach. If you look at the history, I would say that those advocating for an aggressive approach can build a pretty good case to say, when has the U.S. ever not been a rabid dog when it comes to trying to kneecap China? I mean, they're just constantly the only reason that they haven't succeeded is because they don't have enough. They just don't have the power to do it. But if they could, I mean, we would have, destroyed China's. We would have subjugated China long ago, but we just don't have the tools to do it. Now I'm looking at Trump and what he's been doing in terms of causing huge amounts of like internal chaos with our allies, and we're totally preoccupied with infighting as well as tariffs among allies and stuff. Like, we're in a pretty messy situation. If I'm in the faction in the Chinese government that's advocating for an aggressive approach, I'd be like, you will not find a better time to launch an attack than now. Because they can't get there. There's no way that they can circle the allies and have a coordinated response to us. You know, I mean, just like, focus your attack on America, leave an out for all of its allies, spare them, and, you know, drive a wedge between them, because they're already putting a wedge between themselves and the allies on their own. Just magnify the effect, and why wait? I mean, if you wait, you know, maybe that window of opportunity closes, and it's like, what, you want to let Trump get all his ducks in order before he can, like, you know, negotiate a peace with Russia, get everyone happy, get on board.
Exactly.
And then they can turn to China, and we're just sitting here waiting for them to show up at the negotiation table so they can push us around. I'd be like, no, attack. Mm-hmm. And I feel like China is in attack mode. That's the thing. I'm wondering. Actually, I want to ask you that. Do you think China is actually in an attack mode right now? Like, we're so used to, I feel like Americans, and to be honest, a lot of Chinese, are so accustomed to China being a passive player that only knows how to play defense, and they're proud of China's fortress-like quality to constantly play defense against the barbarian Americans and all that other stuff. But it's like, China know how to play offense? Yeah. Because that's what America plays all the time. I mean, say what you will about us, but we play offense. And China plays defense.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is that going to change? Great question. Because if it changes, I feel
You're posing a question that isn't asked enough, because people take this position for granted, take this basically defensive position, defensive and constant, right? They don't, they do retaliate, but only in some measured way, and always fairly minimally. The retaliation is always a little bit less than the attack. So it really would be a change if they did this. And it's a fair question. It's a very good question whether, having this leverage in reserve, they are now able to use it strategically, and whether this is the moment. There are some signs against this. Let me start with that. So, for example, you know, it looks like they're really focused on the technology, on domestic economy, as always, but on the technology side. You know, when Xi gathered all these this bunch of major tech bosses, that was a signal. We're going to back you guys. You know, this enterprise is important. We want to excel at this. So it seemed as if, okay, we're going to focus on development, right? Not on war. It's going to be inward focused. It's going to be, and if you, I've not been following the two sessions as closely as I should, but there the signals again are also very domestic, geared towards a domestic development. But that's their usual diplomatic style. I do think that the language shift, though, and notice what they just did with, the Australians. I think there's a signal here that that's going to be more directly reciprocal in a language that you guys understand. So I think you're right. It's starting. You know, the ships, to be specific, right? In case people are not
I think so too. Aware, I mean, these, I don't know.
Two Chinese Navy destroyers, you know, doing live fire exercises a few hundred kilometers off the Australian coast. Just giving Australians a taste of what the Chinese side experiences with all these freedom of navigation quote-unquote operations that Australia conducts together with the US or at the US behest off the coast of China. So they've gone around the Australia, right? And the Australians have no response to this. Yeah, it's basically a show of strength. You would never have expected this a few years ago. This is the first time. This is venturing all the way into Australian waters. And they basically went around, you know, Australia doing this. So there's a very clear sign that it's going to be reciprocal in a new way now. Now, the thing about the Chinese diplomatic style is they don't bluff. The language is very measured, but when they say they're going to do something, I just wouldn't, you know, I would bet that they're going to do it.
See, this is the thing that I find troublesome with a lot of Chinese accounts right now is right. I feel like they're just so bought into this notion of good guy China and this idea that China is the adult in the room who will never make an aggressive move. It's, you know, and I'm like, I don't really know about that because I feel like why else? Okay. If I mean, leaving aside the military stuff, which is its own topic, okay, and way beyond my ken, I know other people who've really followed that stuff, but like, I'm not as interested or conversant in that. But yeah, I heard about
went
that
around live, the Australian coast,
the two destroyers who
they did freedom of navigation,
rounded Australia, freedom of navigation,
yes,
and
exactly.
All that. You know, just trying to, yeah, just trying to show, hey, we can touch you. You know what I mean? We can touch you. Okay. But like, there's a whole military side to this, obviously. On the economic side, I mean, we've spent so long trying to kneecap China. It goes all the way back. You know, the blog post was like, God, this, you know, I just realized, I mean, the Scott Bessent's assault on the Asian financial system began basically the same day Hong Kong was handed back to China by the UK.
Yeah,
it coincided perfectly to the week, and the way that I feel, you know, in hindsight, you know, the strategy is seems more clear now, which is, you know, like throw these countries into chaos, economic chaos, bail them out, and then put covenants in the bailout to say, you know, you will act, you'll be tamed, you will not nationalize your industries, you will not throw up trade barriers, you will not regulate foreign capital, you know, like we've been doing this since the 90s and probably before in Asia. And then by the time we get to the 2000s and 2010s, like we're actively trying to destroy the Chinese economy. We're constantly trying to throw a net or contain Chinese growth and openly saying it. I mean, we openly brag about it. We don't even hide it. Okay. Like we've gotten so used to this being the normal state of affairs that we kind of imagine that China just sits there going like, "Yep, that's the way of the world." You know, that's what happens when you're the China man and you're second in play, you know, you're second best. And well, we just learn to eat shit and move on, I guess. And I feel like a lot of the pro Chinese accounts, to be honest, have sort of internalized this good guy China mentality to say, well, we're not like the, you know, the bad Americans that go around saying
that doesn't reflect how
things.
A lot of Chinese people feel.
We're, you know, we're honest people.
No, there's a little
bit. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not
even
so
the,
sure.
Yeah, the discussions among ordinary people.
Yeah.
But also among commentators, you know, domestically.
Yeah.
If you listen. Well, you see both sides and you see some real hawks as well. Mm-hmm.
What do you see?
I think who would say precisely what you're saying. So that's there. It's not as all, you know, placid as all that. The government style is very, very sort of solid and measured and calculated, Which is precisely why when they start doing things like sending destroyers to your coast, you know, you should pay attention. It is, you know, just learn not to need very, you know, crude signs. I mean, they just ignore what the Chinese say. People have gotten completely used to ignoring Chinese statements and to interpreting Chinese actions, all their actions as irrational. That has a way of dulling you to what they're actually saying. And it's not that complicated. We're not going to take any shit anymore. So, yeah. You're right. You're right. They're not reading the signal. There is a signal. There is a difference between their statements today and a year ago, let's say.
Yeah, and I get this intuitive sense that...
Yeah, of course there is. There's a Chinese mind. There's a Chinese political culture.
There is such a thing? There is, I think.
Right? Or strategic culture.
The Chinese mind, yeah. I get the feeling that when the Chinese decide to use force, they're going to use it as decisively as possible, meaning they'll strike hard, very hard. I don't think they're going to strike, you know, I don't think that they're going to play around, let's put it that way. Okay, sorry about that. Quick, we had a little disruption. But yeah, I was saying like, yeah, I feel like that the decision, if China decides to strike, like in let's say to change its mode from sort of cooperation with like sort of like mirror, like, you know, okay, you put a tariff, I put a tariff on, we mirror your action. If you take the tariff off, I take the tariff off. That's still sort of like a defensive, you know, kind of posture to say we are
signaling a willingness reactive, to
cooperate.
Yeah.
But if they move into warfare, I feel like that stops. And what we have grown very accustomed to here in America, which is that China only plays defense. They will do mirror techniques. So like, you know, they won't hit us harder than we hit them. So it's up to us how far this goes. I'm not sure about that anymore. I'm not sure. I look at that language. I look at the shift. I look at the vulnerabilities. I look at the way even some American commentators have put this at, when they look at the big picture, which is to say we are decoupling and China now is a lot more independent and or a lot less dependent on the United States and the United States is on China.
Yes.
China does not have a monetary or supply chain reliance on the U.S. And I'm not sure China is all that reliant on the U.S. market as it was before.
Yeah, a lot less.
I think that they could manage a hard decoupling much better than we could. So the only question is, who's going to initiate that hard decoupling? And I feel like it's not out of the question that China might do it. Because if they look at the long term, if they look at Trump's overall strategy, this looks like a four-year-long attempt to strangle China. Mm. And I think that we have a long, we have telegraphed this, which is we want to continue using maximal pressure to use debt strategies and use hard power tactics to get the entire world to try and isolate China. And I just don't think that China's up for another 4 years of this when they don't have to put up with it. And yeah, I'm a little worried that that means that that you know, a real economic war is brewing. And in fact, that China may have been in war mode this whole time. They're just preparing for economic war. And it's really hard, as crazy as that sounds, like it's hard to dismiss that given like how awful and provocative the U.S. strategy has been for like nearly a decade.
A wise U.S. strategist would consider this. Yeah. No, because the thing to understand is that if they do retaliate, or if they do go into this, take the initiative, I think they have, economically, they have escalation dominance. There's more that they can do, and the more they have in reserve. And most strategists and all these commentators talking about China are talking about a China of 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago. And that's not China today. I mean, China is a lot stronger than it was then, and the global economy is different. So you're right, it is a lot less dependent on the U.S. markets. They've been bringing down the amount of debt they hold, U.S. debt. So, and that is actually a calculation. You know, they're wondering, so they don't take for granted, for example, that this debt is secure. So,
I mean,
so those calculations, right? If you might default on the treasuries, that kind of thing. Ridiculous.
They've gone so far as to seemingly develop strategies in order to deleverage the U.S. dollar around the world, meaning they so with their bond issuance in, I believe, Saudi Arabia, where they're testing out the ability to raise, to issue U.S. dollar denominated debt at actually a lower rate than the U.S. Treasury itself. The Chinese seem to be developing a strategy where they can both lower their U.S. dollar assets in reserve and at the same time become a lender of U.S. dollars by borrowing from sort of like high reserve countries like Saudi Arabia and lending them to indebted countries.
Yeah, that really and that will, interesting move that they made.
Yeah, and that basically takes all of the debt, the sort of debt-entrapped vassals, and gives them a way out by refinancing that debt so that they've owed that money to China at better financing rates, I might add.
Yeah,
they'll actually face China, for which they can have a trading relationship, and they can pay off that debt through actual exports. And rather than just sort
that
of
was
like,
really interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, why, you know, and there was strategy behind that, and I'm thinking like, that doesn't just happen by accident. Like there, that's part of the strategy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So,
no, clearly the game is people understand that the economic warfare that we are in economic warfare. That
we, I yeah.
As I've said, you know, the U.S. is waging hybrid war on China, and they're not so stupid as this not to understand this.
Right.
Yeah. Remember that the perception even of COVID here, I'm not saying the government has said this or thinks this, but, you know, the vast majority of people, right, see this, even COVID as part of that.
Yeah.
Rightly or wrongly. Okay. Because it's clear now, even in the US, that this was engineered. Was created in a lab. The Chinese clearly don't know. You know, it's either it was released accidentally from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, or it was released in the U.S. It's either an accidental thing or it's deliberate. But it's a U.S. project. It's a U.S. Made product, right? So if you're sitting here and you're Chinese, I mean, you realize the scale. I mean, you realize the type of attack you're under. So it already is warfare, and that's not a new realization. You can't go back from kidnapping someone's daughter and trying to destroy the guy's, you know, the company. The wonder is that Westerners don't see this. They think they can do this to another country and expect people to just sit back and not take it as war, actually.
Right.
Yeah, there's this kind of thing where you can do all this shit to people. You just imagine this being done to you. So
it's fuck around and find out. And I feel like You know, I think we're really underestimating the willingness of China to go on the offense. China will play offense. How do you think China got to where it is today? So I don't know. I suddenly realized I feel like I'm really under, I've been underestimating the potential here for a Chinese offensive. Particularly in the economic space, because China has been living under conditions of war for a long time without and playing reciprocal defense, but they have not made an offensive, and they could very easily do it. And I feel like, in fact, I believe they've been marshaling their forces for the past many, many years, specifically so that they could have really like bit fortress, they're fortressed out and they could strike hard and decisively, where they could throw the U.S. economy into a tailspin with a single blow. And, you know, I just thought, just consider the fact that they could destroy our single largest company as an example. I'm not saying, I'm not predicting that they're going to do that. Though Warren Buffett has been selling off Apple very quickly, and he said in the he said in the shareholder meeting, he said, they asked him about it, and he said, I just think that there's a lot going on in the world right now. And this is a man who has said that tariffs are essentially an act of war. So the man said tariffs are an act of war. He said there's a lot going on in the world right now, and he's been absolutely selling the shit out of his Apple holdings, which or in terms of his sort of non-controlling interests, that is the number one stock holding of. Okay, you there?
Yep.
All right. Yep. Sorry. So, sorry, we got a little bit cut off there for a second. We're having some glitches with the Zencastr thing, but I don't know your thoughts on this, man.
Yeah. No, I think this is a perspective that doesn't get aired enough. Well, actually, I haven't seen this. It's not that. Well, there's a lot of China threat mongering of a very crude sort. Just this idea that they're going to attack Taiwan, for example, and it's played within the kind of you know, in the kinetic and military imagination, but very little said about the economic dimension, right? Which is where it's actually far more likely to happen. So the military industrial types, you know, they're very fond of these scenarios, which actually are, many of them are absurd or far-fetched, about China just attacking and so on, and you know, attacking Taiwan. Those are far less, those are things that, scenarios that are far less likely than the sort of economic stuff you're talking about, actually. And you know, it just occurs to me, and I'm just thinking and responding to your question, that the usual way in which China is viewed is, and I'd probably repeat myself on this point, is really crude. You know, it's, they're going to attack Taiwan, they're going to you know, take these islands, they're going to do this and that. But it, because it is that crude, you tend to miss out on exactly the other types of measures that China might take short of actual warfare, kinetic war. And that's a, there's a real possibility. Yeah, those things are in reserve. I would say that right now might be a time, you would think, with the U.S. in this chaotic condition. But I think people are still also holding out for possible negotiations with Trump. Here's the idea that Trump might be angling for a deal, that a lot of this behavior is working up to a, the sort of deal that with China that he's trying to do, he appears to be trying to make with, with Russia.
Yeah.
So this is this idea that he wants a kind of trilateral world. The almost, you know, joke meme thing about him wanting to be like Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill at Yalta. that he sees himself next to these, you know, based guys. And there may be that too. So the Chinese may not pull the trigger, will not do anything drastic until they see, you know, that they see out that possibility. But I think that if people like Scott Bessent continue to push, or the tariff measures are broadened further, then yes, there's a real likelihood that you might trigger exactly the sort of Chinese response that you just outlined.
Yeah, you know,
I too was surprised at how mad they are about sanction, about tariffs, given that it's just it's a 10% on top of tariffs that are already there.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not just the tariffs, it's creating an entire global tariff regime against China, or attempting to do that.
I think part of the problem here is, like, with Russia.
Yeah.
You know, with Russia, it's like, I don't think there is a real reason for us to, there are off ramps with Russia, right? But with China, I feel like there is, you know, when we look at the economics, I feel like China is putting a level of pressure on the United States system that is kind of existential. And it's hard to see an off-ramp where we're going to be allowed to keep the system that we have, the U.S. dollar system, without China sort of being subjugated. And I feel like there is a sort of economic logic to this escalating. And I like, the Chinese may see the writing on the wall to say, regardless of whether Trump is in a negotiating mood or not, the fact is that China taking the lead in terms of technology and production in the world is an existential threat to the United States, because our system is predicated upon their not being a leader like that against us. We need to be that leader, or such leaders need to be subjugated within the U.S. dollar system. And China's neither of them is upsetting those conditions.
Yeah.
And I don't think China's going to be. Yeah. It's too late. Yeah.
Yeah. It already is. This is not. China already is the leader.
Yes. It's already the leader. And yeah. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is that I'm not sure that the temperament of specific leaders is going to make a difference in coming to the conclusion that, like, there's going to be like a violent change in the economic order in the world, and
right,
there's going to be a winner and a loser.
Mm. You mean that if China reads the situation structurally, they see that it's inevitable?
I think so.
That there's no stepping back from it.
Yeah. That's what I'm concerned about. I don't know that for a fact, but it seems to me that way, that they understand that the United States, you know, has to, I mean, like, think about what our goals are here, right? Like, our goal is, like, if you boil it down, fundamentally, we're saying that the money is, I think it boils down to this. I think it boils down to, money is more important than production. Like, money is the thing that at the bottom of wealth and value and power, not technology and production and innovation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's money. And the U.S. wants to enforce a money-based order. And China is not playing that game.
You see, in that sense, very, very interesting. There is a divide. There is a very fundamental divide. Yeah, people say, oh no, there's no longer an ideological divide, right? Why can't you get along? But this is, it's just as irreconcilable, or probably more irreconcilable. This is a systemic sort of divide. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a reality too. It's not just ideological, but it is like sort of the basis for America's, like, you know, material survival. Like we live off money. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
China lives off production. China lives off supply chain. China lives off innovation. China lives off infrastructure. China lives off of export. We're the opposite. We don't export shit. We just make money. There's a great scene in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I don't know if you know that show, where Frank, one of the characters, he goes back to running his hedge fund, and he's got Charlie, who's like this sort of like dumb intern guy, and he asks Frank, okay, who's paying for all? Because Frank is like, okay, we're gonna do this, we're gonna get our suits made, we're gonna have you know, I want to fly first class, this and that. And Frank goes, I got a question. What do we make? And he goes, we make money. What are you talking about? He's like, okay, no, I mean, I know we make money, but like, what do we produce? And he's like, we produce wealth. What are you asking? And he was like, no, I know, but like, what do we sell? He's like, sell? Leave that to the chinks. You know, meaning like, the creation, like, we just, like, I don't know how to put this, man, because it's so fundamental, but it's just like,
yeah,
we think that the people who make stuff should be in the back. They're the back of the house people, you know, like, you hide those orcs behind the door. It's like the kitchen where the food is made. That's not what's important. What's important is the dining room and the host and the lobby, and, you know, that's the important stuff. And the people making shit in the back, you know, you underpay them and you keep them in the dark and you whip them when they don't move fast enough. And that's not okay. Anyway, that's my final thought. I'll stop blabbering and I'll let you have the final word on this.
I don't know if I have a final word. I don't feel very articulate on this because I think I'm drawn into the kind of the freshness of your perspective on this, even though it should be so obvious. It really is a question about, okay, what have we gotten to? Let's try to summarize that. You're saying there is a fundamental contradiction between the kind of financial capitalism of the US and the industrial capitalism of China, as Michael Hudson might put it, right? For the US, the two can't coexist. And I mean, the fundamental struggle is actually the contradiction is in the US, because people do recognize that, as you say, you know, the economy being just about money, the financial economy, is unsustainable, even for the US. Because, you know, you have this enormous debt overhang. There is a recognition in the Trump administration, or finally the people who are serious enough to try to do something about it, even if they do it in an unserious way, are here. So very drastic measures are being made to address that issue. We didn't talk about the crazy kind of port fees that are going to be levied on Chinese registered vessels, in the hope of or in service of reviving U.S. Shipbuilding. So they do recognize that you have to make things, that you have to have an industrial economy to be a great power. So the unsustainability of this model, I mean, that is recognized by some people in the US, and you might think that the Trump administration is serious about addressing this. They're still, of course, pushing the problem out onto China, trying to suppress Chinese, or making these protectionist moves against Chinese shipbuilding. What do I think about the you know, what's going to happen next? I don't know. Are the Chinese going to figure out if, you know, you would worry if they were smart enough to, the Chinese side, to figure out that this is a, that it's inevitable, that the clash is inevitable, not just inevitable, but unavoidable, then they might choose a moment to strike. You're right. Economically. Meanwhile, quite apart from doing anything drastic with something like, you know, doing certain action on Apple, or with the sale of treasuries or on the currency front, then there's just this business of building a different multilateral institutions, BRICS, and so on. So everything takes on a far more tense and weighty nature, right, given these considerations. But you're right. I think in our conversation, I think we got real about the conflict, that it is economic war, that, I mean, this is the premise, right, that it's a struggle that from which there's no easy solution. There's no easy compromise, right?
I think that's right. I think the fact that the Trump administration recognizes these problems and the limits of the financial order is a test of whether the U.S. has taken this particular strategy too far, and our insistence on being the dominant economic power in the world is no longer realistic. And thus, will that spill over into some sort of test of power, you know, to say that the U.S. will actually put its cards on the table to say, we're going to regain our preeminence through sheer power struggle, i.e. warfare, economic warfare. I still don't think real war is on the table, real physical war is on the table. But I do think that economic war is certainly on the table. I don't think that the U.S. is going to sort of like take its place at the global table at like the number two or three or even four spot in the future. We're not going to do that. We may have to, but we're going to be forced in that position. And that's the really ugly part of this. Is like, you know, we may have to find through hard power struggle, like where our place on the global pecking order is, and it may not be number one anymore. And that's a very scary thought, because I don't know. I don't think the U.S. is a particularly humble country. It's going to be hard to humble us into that. So
you see, your argument is more than about just the psychology, the political psychology, which is significant enough, right? This inability to climb down, or inability to accept being anything but the supremo. But it's also about the structure of the U.S. economy. You cannot afford not to be dominant, not to have dollar dominance, for example.
Yeah.
Well, that would be scary, right? If that were the case, that there is no easy way out of that. Here's another thing. Some people think, okay, things are with Trump, there might be a move towards a more a spheres of influence world, you know, in which we carve out the Western Hemisphere, the U.S. goes back to manifest destiny and the Monroe Doctrine. And by implication, you leave China to its own sphere. But that's not acceptable either. You take somebody like Elbridge Colby, you know, who's a nominee for Deputy Secretary of Defense. He clearly is sort of a realist, a more restrained realist, and we're talking about restraint relative to the neocons, but who still thinks that, no, the U.S. can't just stick to the Western Hemisphere, Because Asia is where the action is. Asia is where the global economy is. You can't allow China to dominate Asia. So there's no way out of this. I don't believe the US can return to a sphere of the Western Hemisphere, because the center of gravity of the global economy is not in the Western Hemisphere and will not be in the Western Hemisphere. It's going to be in Asia. It's going to be China, Southeast Asia, at some point India. So even that is, you know, not going to work. Yeah. So although there are moves, right? There's tendencies in the Trump administration. You might think it's headed towards a more restrained, realist position, in which you have a balance of power between great powers. With the U.S., then in a great power world, you have at least that degree of parity, right? China, Russia, the U.S. Not equally powerful in all respects, but having to treat each other with a degree of... They have to conduct diplomacy with each other. They have to balance each other, rather than the world that, before this, in which you pretended that there was you didn't need diplomacy. You have this hegemony, a unipolar hegemony. So if you're going to go into this world, I think the U.S. would still fight for Asia, or risk being, in their view, marginalized in the Americas. I mean, it sounds absurd, right? You've got half the planet, really, you know, the Americas and the Pacific, and you still feel that's sort of not enough. But it's probably not enough for the U.S. way of life, for the U.S. economy, for the financial economy. So, yeah, it's not a pretty place to be leaving this conversation, to be ending this conversation. But I guess we hit on some of the major contradictions.
Yeah. Yep. I feel like there's a lot more risk in the system than a lot of us think. That's my risk conclusion.
There's no solution.
This is a really risky and dangerous situation. And I realized, like, I think that we have been tricked into complacency because of China's reserve, that we think of China as a
restrained
as a reserve, country, as with limitless restraint and patience, and they will basically play ball with us until we figure out, you know, what we want to do, and I don't know if we can rely on that going forward. I think I'm not making a prediction one way or another, other than I think once we start talking about economic warfare, we really have to open up our minds to the possibilities. And there are a lot of possibilities that are not pretty. There's a lot of things.
The blob doesn't like to talk about this, you know, because they have no escalation dominance in this.
Yeah.
They have no cards in this, actually. Very, very few. Oh, you know, we're going to seize them. Yeah.
They warned us in Alaska. They said, you shouldn't be coming at us from a position of strength. You're in a weak position. And I don't think that was just bluffing or tough talk or whatever. It was a statement of like, guys, check yourself right now. You're not in a good situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, stop acting like you're in a good situation, because if you keep going like this, we're going to be forced to strike and it's going to be bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be bad for you. We don't want to hurt you that bad, but we can, you know. Yeah. And
when I say the Chinese don't bluff, right, I'm not making some sort of statement about, you know, Chinese culture, you know, these people are straight. No. And it's not even just a matter of style. Look at the way their diplomacy works.
Yeah.
They don't bluff. That's not one of the instruments there, right? And if you understand how decision-making is conducted, one is very aware, actually, living here, it's a gigantic bureaucracy. It's the world's oldest bureaucracy. Yeah. And decisions don't get made sort of randomly and on the loose. Even this, you were right to point out that they've been preparing for what we have today. Xi Jinping is all about that, including what people think of as sort of tightening up domestically, right? Or repression or kind of greater discipline. All of that has been in service of preparedness for the conflict that was already telegraphed by the US in 2010, 2011. You know, this pivot to Asia business and stirring up issues in the South China Sea. So, I mean, the US has telegraphed these things over, as you rightly point out, over more than a decade. And they're not stupid, and they haven't been sitting on their hands. They have been preparing for this. So, yeah, you're right. We could see something that we've never seen before from China. And if you don't think that's possible, we've already seen a lot of stuff that we have never seen before from them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Should we leave it there?
Yeah.
We should continue this. We'll talk more about this in the you know,
there's just so much
going to be happening and everything, but
yes.
It's good to catch up as always.
Yes. So. I think we should touch base on it. It's
all right.
Yeah, great talking to you.
All right. So we'll see you next time, Al. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.